working with someone when they have that revelation. Like, why are you
crazy? It's making sure
that maybe looking at this case, it could be an interesting process piece.
Okay.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. A man named Terry Robinson made a killing in the radio business. He invested in satellite radio when it was just beginning to be a kind of commercial possibility. He got rich and he retired early. So how did he fall for a business proposition that seemed absolutely crazy to everyone around him and left his family broke?
I told Terry, I said, I think this guy's a sleazebag. He's a con artist. I wouldn't even give him the time of day. But Terry was, let's go after it, go get it, take the chance.
Maria Konnikova, who's something of an expert in the art of the con, will help explain.
There's something that motivates all of us, and a con artist is able to identify what it is that we're missing, what it is that we most want, and to give it to us. And you'll find yourself unable to resist.
That's later in the hour. We're going to start by taking a look at the midterm elections, which are just a month away. As if the Republicans didn't have enough to contend with, including allegations against Brett Kavanaugh that have made this the ugliest Supreme Court nomination for a generation, they have a president who tends to undercut them on the economy. Most Republicans want to stick with the positive numbers they have. They can boast about strong employment and economic growth, but Donald Trump, in case you hadn't noticed, is not most Republicans. Trump feels that tariffs and trade wars are a winning issue with his base, and he doesn't really care what economists think either, even economists in his cabinet. He's just imposed another enormous round of tariffs on China, and China has predictably retaliated. Staff writer John Cassidy has been looking at the administration's trade policies and how they're playing out during the midterm election campaign. He spoke with Sheila Kolhatkar, who reports for us on business and labor.
We're in this increasingly hostile period right now in terms of the rhetoric coming out of the Trump administration around foreign trade. And last week, tariffs on $200 billion worth of goods from China went into effect. And China responded by adding $60 billion worth of tariffs onto U.S. products. And this comes after major tensions between the U.S. and Mexico, Europe, and Canada over trade. How politically risky are these tariffs to Donald Trump as we head into the midterms?
Well, I certainly think a lot of people on the Republican side would have wished he'd waited until after the midterms, just because they're already in bad shape. And even though, as I think we'll discuss, the trade politics of trade are quite complicated, it's a diversion from the good economic news, which, you know, the sort of Paul Ryans and the Mitch McConnells of the world would rather be talking about: a strong economy, a low unemployment rate, high rates of economic growth, etc. Instead of that, the big economic news is, you know, Trump slapping more tariffs on Chinese retaliating. It's going to hurt consumers, and it's going to hurt Republicans in a few individual states too, probably.
So obviously these tariffs are going to translate to higher prices and to higher production costs. How quickly do those effects start to be felt?
Well, I mean, the effects of the previous round are already being felt. One of the examples is washing machines. They put tariffs on washing machines, and prices of washing machines have apparently gone up 10-15%, and the sales have gone down. Obviously, these things have to come around the world, so it's not immediate. But the $200 billion that have been slapped on last week, you know, that's probably going into effect over the next month or so. And what's new about these tariffs is the $200 billion are on a very wide range of goods, 6,000 and lots of sort of consumer goods, desktop computers, lighting fixtures, furniture, some forms of clothing, etc. So that's really going to start hurting the consumer rather than just businesses and farmers.
How is this likely to help Trump? I mean, the timing of this and the way he keeps bringing it up over and over suggests he thinks this is going to help sell his message to certain groups of people. So what's his rationale for thinking it will help?
Again, I think we have to go back to the fact that the basic fact about the American economy is it's huge. $20 trillion of GDP. It's just an immensely complicated machine with 300 million people, thousands and thousands of different industries, hundreds of thousands of firms, etc. So if you slap a bunch of tariffs on things, and there's retaliatory tariffs, different sectors, different industries, even within states get hit differently. Now, Trump's big argument And the big political argument for him has always been he's defending the sort of industrial Midwest, the Rust Belt. And you can see that the basic policies are pretty popular there. You can see that from the reaction, for example, of Sherrod Brown, Democratic senator who's up for re-election in Ohio in a close race. And he has supported Trump's steel and aluminum tariffs. And he's also urged Trump to stay tough in talks with China and not give in. So clearly, Trump's policies play some places. They play in the Rust Belt. They play in big sort of centers of steel. But at the same time, they don't play it elsewhere. Just across the border in Missouri, for example, Claire McCaskill is attacking Trump because his import tariffs on steel and aluminum are hurting local factories which use those goods as raw materials. There's a nail factory which is about to close or is threatening to close, and she's blaming the tariffs. So this sort of cuts, you know, at quite fine levels within different states. You can see other states, too, where the Republicans are actually on defensive about trade and the Democrats are the ones who are attacking. I mentioned Missouri. There's also Tennessee and North Dakota.
I was just going to ask you a bit about how the tariffs are playing out in the Tennessee Senate race. So the Democratic nominee, Phil Bredesen, is a former governor popular in this state. But is it unusual that the Tennessee race would be so close?
It is, yeah. I mean, Trump won the state, I think, by 25 or 26 points in 2016. So you would think this would be the Republicans would be home free here. And it's obviously Bob Corker who's retiring, so it is a Republican seat. It's much, much closer than the Republicans would like. Bredesen is not in the lead. Marsha Blackburn, the Republican congressman, is trying to replace her, still holds a narrow lead in all the polls. But it looks like, you know, we're talking 3 or 4 points, and it's sort of within the margin of error. And one of the reasons is hitting the Republicans hard on trade, pointing out, for example, Chattanooga, Tennessee is a big BMW factory. They all use imported steel and imported goods, which are being hit by tariffs. So, you know, that's a typical sort of southern Republican state where you think Trump's policies would be popular, but in this case, they seem to be playing against him.
And how is his opponent handling the trade issue then?
Well, you see this in Tennessee and in North Dakota. It's very awkward. It's a sort of paradox here. Some of these Republican voters don't like the trade policies, but Trump is still very popular in these states. If you look at his approval ratings, much higher there than nationally. So they don't want to distance themselves from Trump, both because he's popular and because if they do distance themselves from him, he may well start attacking them on Twitter. They need his support. So they're generally, what you're seeing is they're expressing concerns about the impact of some of these tariffs, but they're not coming out straightforwardly and saying this is a mistake, you know, we need to end this trade war. They're trying to straddle. And that's why it's a good issue for the Democrats, because they've got these candidates pinned. They can't distance themselves from Trump, but they don't want to defend Trump's unpopular policies.
So in North Dakota, the Democratic Senator Heidi Heitkamp just ran an ad about how tariffs are hurting soybean farmers.
Yeah.
Let's take a listen to that.
China is canceling their contracts to buy soybeans. North Dakota is losing hundreds of millions of dollars worth of business. But when you ask Kevin Cramer why he supports the trade war, he criticizes farmers.
But I hear all kinds of hysteria.
There's a potential short-term pain. We don't have a very high pain threshold in the United States of America.
Mr. Cramer, that trade war is costing my family a lot of money, and you don't seem to care.
The administration announced a $12 billion aid package for farmers, a sort of farmer bailout package to help them cope with the tariffs. Do you think that's going to be enough to help counteract this argument about how he's inflicting pain on farmers?
Well, I think it certainly helped to some point. I mean, I love the Republicans. They're always in favor of socialism for farmers. You know, capitalism, capitalism for everybody else, socialism for the farmers. But, I mean, if you're just sort of going on a sort of ad hoc basis, listening to the vox pops that have been done there, farmers seem to be saying, yes, they welcome the relief from this bailout, but they'd much rather to be selling their goods properly, and they don't want this trade war to go on forever. Now, then when you say to them, well, is it bad enough that you're going to vote against Donald Trump or vote for the Democrats, you don't seem to get very many yeses as yet. But if it goes on and on, you know, we shall see whether it may have more political impact. Trump is selling it as a temporary thing, which is, you know, short-term pain for long-term gain, which is exactly what Kevin Cramer is saying in North Dakota as well.
Do you think it's really temporary?
Well, I don't think it's temporary. I mean, it looks to me like Trump likes tariffs. I mean, you know, you don't have to, doesn't look to me. He says it every day on Twitter, you know, tariffs work. I think there's a division in the White House, though. There are some people in the Trump administration who see tariffs as just a way to bully the Chinese into giving up some of their mercantilist practices. And you actually see some support from that even in the sort of economic policy institutes in Washington. The sort of feeling is that negotiating with the Chinese hasn't been that successful, so somebody had to do something. They don't necessarily support Trump, but they can see a certain logic to it. But, you know, that is a completely different argument, imposing Trump's tariffs temporarily so the Chinese have to belly up, to what Trump seems to be talking about is permanent tariffs so we can, you know, rebuild the steel industry and rebuild all sorts of industries in the heartlands. In order to do that, you would need very heavy tariffs indefinitely. And I think that's more to Trump's liking. I don't think he sees this as temporary at all.
As the midterms get closer, do you think the Democrats have been effective at developing a consistent message around this trade issue?
Well, I think Democrats don't want a consistent message around it because they want their candidates to have a bit of flexibility. I mentioned the example of Sherrod Brown in Ohio, who is basically not completely supporting Trump, but has supported the initial tariffs and has expressed sympathy for the overall approach he's taking to China. Whereas, you know, in California and New York and places which tend to be very deeply integrated into sort of the world economy in a different way, most of the Democrats in those areas are coming out completely against the tariffs.
Is the fact that there's now a little bit more flexibility around this issue maybe a healthy sign? Because for a long time, there seemed to be just agreement on both sides that free trade was generally a good and desirable thing. Now there's a little bit more of a debate around it. Maybe that's good.
Well, I mean, if you believe in political diversity, I mean, I guess you can make that argument. There always were people on both sides, you know, who were protectionists. Pat Buchanan ran as a protectionist in 92 for the Republicans. He just could never break through against the sort of country club Chamber of Commerce Republicans, as I say, Gephardt and others in the Democratic Party. I think that diversity opinion has always been there. What's changed is that, a protectionist has taken over, demolished basically everybody else in the Republican Party. So that's a big difference. And, whether you think that's good or bad basically depends on whether you think that Trump's right on this trade stuff. And I think that he's not right overall. I mean, I think he's responding to some legitimate grievances in some parts of the country from some industries and some legitimate grievances about Chinese mercantilism in some areas. But overall, starting a huge trade war, you know, is a bad idea. There are other ways to go about this. You can do it through the WTO. If we're going to take on the Chinese, we need the support of the Europeans. We need the support of Canada, the support of Mexico. Trump's just blundering in because he thinks if I just slap tariffs on everybody, you know, they'll buckle to me. And I think that's the wrong way to go about it. And it's not going to work.
Thanks for talking to me, John.
Thank you.
That's John Cassidy speaking with Sheila Kolhatkar, and they're both staff writers at The New Yorker, and you can find all of their coverage, trade and business, at newyorker.com. This week in our podcast, Politics and More, Jeannie Suk-Gerson, who's a contributing writer as well as a professor of law at Harvard, takes a close look at the Brett Kavanaugh hearings. That's in Politics and More from The New Yorker, and you can find it wherever you get your podcasts. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come. Welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Our next story is a family story and a kind of psychological mystery in which a young woman tries to understand her late father, some decisions he made that she just can't quite get her head around. The New Yorker's Maria Konnikova, who's kind of our psychology expert, is here to tell us more.
I've written a lot about psychology, human behavior, why we do the things we do. In my last book, The Confidence Game, I tried to get at this question by looking at con artists and their victims. Why we fall for con artists, what it is about the nature of belief that makes us so susceptible to people who are looking to take advantage of us. After the book was published, I started hearing a lot from people who had been conned. And that's actually how I first heard from a woman named Maggie Robinson Katz. Maggie was trying to understand what had happened to her own family. At first, all she had to go on were these cassettes. Here's Maggie.
The cassette tapes had been in my stepmom's garage for 5 years. There were over 100 of them, just sitting in plastic bins. And it took me those 5 years to finally take one out and start listening.
Thanks for calling the Romance City. Good morning.
Yes, Mr. Stuckey, please.
On the tapes were phone calls my dad made between 2004 and 2011, the year he died. He was recording the calls he made with a man named Jim Stuckey, who was from West Virginia, but was living in the Philippines.
Hi. You trying to call me?
Yeah, I just tried to call you on the house phone.
For most of the calls, Jim and my dad seemed to have almost the exact same conversation.
Okay, now, what will the advance be?
Well, I have no idea yet.
My dad asking when he's going to get money he was promised, and Jim saying something's gone wrong. Someone is holding things up again.
I need something in my hands, which I still
But Jim tells my dad not to worry. Their money is sure to come through tomorrow.
This thing should be finished.
You've said that probably 100 times, Jim.
And I'm not trying to be argumentative. I'm trying to work it out.
When I started listening to the tapes, it was the first time I heard my dad's voice in 5 years.
Jim, I need money. I need it now.
So do we.
Jim.
But as I listened, I started to wonder about Jim. Who is he? And what did he have to do with what happened to my family?
That's what happened, Jim. Somebody stole my $90,000.
Okay. I'll talk to you in a while.
Okay, bye.
In the summer of 2011, my dad found out he had stage 4 colon cancer. I remember flying home to get to the hospital and being told that not only did my dad have just a few days left to live, but we were broke. Somehow, my dad had lost all his money and kept it from us. We didn't even have enough to pay his hospital bills. This wasn't the way it was supposed to end.
Live via satellite, the Transtar Radio Network.
When I was a kid, I wasn't that close to my dad. He was busy running a radio network called Transtar.
Transtar, with exciting.
It was one of the first to use satellite technology for radio. And that innovation made my dad very rich.
This is Transtar.
We lived in a giant house. The kind that had multiple wings. I remember cars slowing down to gawk at our Tudor-style mansion.
Like, we were a pretty big Laserdisc family. Then maybe just being a Laserdisc family alone just, like, makes me feel the wealth of growing up.
That's my brother Patrick. Along with the rest of the family, we were members of a country club, took etiquette class for kids. We dressed up in nice clothes when we flew first class. It was important to my dad that we presented as the wealthy family we were.
You know, that's what he was raised in, kind of like East Coast, real classic WASPy sort of stuff. You know, your Kennedys, your Bushes.
Bumper and grinder there. Don't start yelling out initials at him.
This is how I like to remember my dad. This is a video from 1989. My dad's on stage with his friend's band, Flash Cadillac, singing an Elvis song. Because it's the 80s, he's wearing a white suit with an open collar shirt, and he's kind of pulling it off. On stage, my dad seemed larger than life. And in some ways, he was. When I was growing up, he'd always talk about his swim records at Dartmouth College and tell the story about the time he turned down an invitation to hang out with Paul McCartney. my stepmom Vivian fell in love with that version of Terry Robinson.
I saw your father across the room and we kind of caught each other's eye.
They met at a party a few years after my parents had split up.
And then he went up and sang with the band, which was really cool.
That led to a date.
And it was the worst first kiss ever. I mean, we missed. It was a disaster.
Vivian started dating my dad when he had already retired from radio. He was about 50 when he stopped working and started spending time in Florida, where he met a boat builder named Dan Johnston.
It's an industrial area. This is the quietest.
Back then, Dan would build a boat for anyone who asked.
You know, one of my employees was asking me earlier. He said, well, Dan, he said, you knew everybody in the Cartagena cartel and you knew the Cali cartel. Not that I dealt with them, but I built boats for everybody, right?
I wanted to talk to Dan because his name was on some documents I found on my dad's laptop. Turns out that my dad and Dan once had a business relationship with that guy from the tapes, Jim Stuckey.
Well, there's an interesting thing.
Dan says Jim had a business proposal for them to set up a shipyard in Saudi Arabia.
And I said, not a chance in hell. I told Terry, I said, I think this guy's a sleazebag, he's a con artist. I wouldn't even give him the time of day. But Terry was, let's go after it, go get it, take the chance. You know, your dad was, he was a risk taker. I'm just really curious how long he still had a relationship with this guy for. Did that go on for a long time?
Up until he died.
Wow. That is, that's shocking. So if it was 2000 or 99, I mean, we're talking 12 years of he was still involved with that guy. What would he have been involved in? What was it?
That's very confusing. It's really hard to figure out.
It is absolutely insane. You know, the U.S. Fed has been involved. We were going to get the $10 million out through Bank of New York, Citibank, Chase, B of A, Credit Suisse, and the bank commissioner of the Philippines have been involved. The president's been involved. You know, I'm writing this stuff down and I'm saying...
The calls all have details like that. The central bank, the U.S. Fed, the governor, the doctor, the Germans, sometimes even the family of Ferdinand Marcos. These are kind of all photos that were included that Jim sent to my dad as kind of like proof of what is. I found this binder full of documents and photos Jim had shared with my dad, and I was hoping it would clear some things up.
Kind of overwhelmed with that one.
So to help me interpret it, I reached out to New Yorker writer Maria Konnikova.
What is this?
So we started looking at this binder. It had all these photos of gold bars, cardboard boxes filled with cash, and weather-beaten metal boxes stamped Federal Reserve bonds.
It's completely overwhelming, and it's totally random.
And Jim claimed he knew where to find this stuff, which was hidden in different parts of the Philippines. If my dad put up the cash, then Jim, acting as a sort of middleman, would be able to help bring the treasures out of hiding. And Jim and my dad would get millions in the process. It's so sad to me to think that he could get all of this information and be like,
Well, yep. You know what? It's human. Like, it's really, really hard to dissuade people who actually want to believe. And it seems like your dad really wanted something to do with his life. And con artists give you meaning. They give you purpose. They tell you a story that makes sense of your life again because they're very, very good at figuring out, you know, what are you missing and what do you want to believe in?
You know, it's more than just the money to me. It is the fact that I have gone from being one of the most respected business people in my community.
You need to reestablish your credibility.
On my credibility and my competency.
Sometimes a large sum of money when everybody had thrown the hat in makes a big difference.
A large sum of money, well, then I'll become a genius again.
Yeah.
Everybody will want to, you know,
be close to me. I mean, I've been here before, you know, when I started the radio network, and when it revolutionized the radio business and made some money, all of a sudden, you know, I was walking around conventions and I was the genius, you know. So yeah, I mean, a reasonable amount of money would reestablish it.
Make a projection. Very shortly, you're going to be that genius again.
Well, I just want my life back.
So actually, one personality type that's really good for con artists is the type of person who your dad seems to have been. Someone who's very entrepreneurial, someone who's open to risks, who's open to new business ventures, because the smarter you think you are, the less susceptible you think you are. And so you kind of think you can navigate in murkier terrain and you become overconfident and then you make poor decisions.
And that was my dad, impulsive. I don't think he did any research. It didn't take me long to learn that in 1989, Jim was charged with defrauding Maryland National Bank of $2.5 million. He pled out on one count and was sentenced to a halfway house. The Treasury Department also has a warning on their website about a Philippines-based con involving fraudulent bonds and treasury certificates. That sounds similar to what Jim was working on. And yet, my dad kept sending him more and more money.
Do you know, Jim, that I've sent you over $1 million? It's not including any interest or anything, that's just cash to you.
I figure it's around more like $600,000, but that doesn't mean it's accurate.
Well, it's all gone to you, and then some has gone on to other people. I've got them itemized by amount.
I don't see how you're figuring that, and I'm not changing anything. I'm not recalibrating anything.
Well, where's the 1.2% going, Jim?
My dad never talked about money with me and my brother. Here I was learning more about him from these cassettes than anything he ever said to me in person.
You're listening to the New Yorker Radio Hour. We're hearing Maggie Robinson Katz's story about her father, a businessman who fell for a very dicey business proposition, or perhaps a scam is the better way to put it. Maggie is trying to understand how her father, smart, worldly, charismatic, could ever have fallen for it. Here's Maggie speaking with her stepmother, Vivian Cobb.
Just diving in. Do you remember the first time you heard about the Philippines?
Yes, I do, actually. Your father and I, very freshly dating. I don't think we had been together more than a couple or 3 months. And he mentioned that he was working with this guy and he was going to make gazillions of dollars on this deal he was working on in the Philippines. And I remember thinking to myself, what the fuck? And just here was this man who I was head over heels in love with him, and I had put him up on this pedestal, and here he was talking about this thing that sounded so absurd to me.
Vivian decided to ignore this Philippines thing, because when she first started dating my dad, it was far from his biggest investment. Out of the millions he had in total assets, most of it would become tied up in real estate in Florida. Then came the market crash in 2007.
And here's where the personality flaw came in and the insecurity. Instead of cutting his losses and saying, okay, I fucked up. I shouldn't have bought all this land. I'll just let it go back to the bank. He blew through all of his cash trying to keep everything afloat.
I had no idea that we were struggling back then. He was always doing his best to keep it from us.
I mean, there were subtleties, like he didn't want to accept dinner invitations because he said, well, I don't want to go to dinner because everybody will expect me to pay because I always pay. It's like, well, why can't you pay? you know, but that part was never talked about, you know. So there were these little subtleties, these little hints, but I certainly didn't have any idea what the degree of that was.
What do you think, how would you describe my dad's relationship to money?
I think it defined him.
Money was so often my dad's way to relate to people. And it worked. I think one of the few times I told my dad I love you was after he bought me a car for my 16th birthday. I remember sitting in the driver's seat thanking him for the car and telling him how sad I was that we weren't closer. He apologized for being absent as a father. We hugged. I cried. We would have never gotten to that moment if he didn't buy me that car in the first place.
Look, I need $1,000. Somehow, some way, you got to get me $1,000.
I'm going to get you more of that. Here,
I refuse to be humiliated in front of my entire family and ruin my daughter's graduation.
All right.
My God, if I got to take my daughter out to Wendy's for, you know, her graduation dinner or graduation lunch. Actually, we're having dinner with my...
Listening to the tapes now, I realized Jim was the only person my dad was open with about losing all he had. For the rest of us, he was keeping up appearances. He kept his country club membership at the same time he was draining my trust fund.
So Jim almost became his psychiatrist, like his confidant.
Again, Maria Konnikova.
The person who he would tell all of these things that he couldn't talk to anyone else about.
Eventually, my stepmom Vivian got a better understanding of the financial trouble my dad was in. So she started speaking out about his work with Jim.
And your dad started hiding it from me. You know, he would leave. He would just sort of slink out. And he knew I was mad that he was sending him money. I said, you know, you cannot send that man any more money. You're enabling him.
Hello.
Hi, Jim.
Oh,
it's me.
Okay.
Well, I just had a huge flare-up, bad morning.
At home?
Yeah. Well, she overheard the conversation at 5 a.m. in the morning. I mean, she knows what...
I think you're going to see the end of it now.
You know what?
I really believe it.
Yeah, I don't.
And I think you're going to start seeing it in the morning.
Yeah, I don't believe it.
Yeah. I'm sorry. I know you've lost a lot of confidence in it, but...
Jim, I've been totally screwed over. So have you.
After the real estate market collapse and the millions he lost to it, my dad's work with Jim became his lifeline. And I could hear in the tapes how this changed him.
Jim, it's 2 o'clock there. It didn't come
this
out.
Is from 2009.
Everybody left this too long.
Nobody left anything. Cares. This has been on somebody been on working this thing all day. You think nobody does anything over here? We have worked.
I'm going down the tube, and you're yelling at me.
I'm not yelling at you.
Yes,
I'm
you are.
There's 1,000 calls coming in here, and I can't get anything done.
Well, this has to get done. I've been put off for another week.
I haven't put you off for anything.
Yeah, I've got to have a plan today on what I'm going to do, and it has to involve me. I either have to go there, I either have to have a representative go there, or I have to go to the FBI, or I have to go to my senator.
That we've got going, and it's not going to happen. We've got something going here, and it's going to finish.
I need money today.
It's going to happen is to go underground and
well,
not going to go.
I can't wait any longer, and
any
you
difference.
keep me on the sidelines.
I don't keep you on the side.
Well, then I'll come over there.
My dad never went to the Philippines. He never contacted the FBI or his senator. He gave Jim so much money. Why wouldn't he spend just a little bit more on a flight to go see what was going on? Instead, he left Vivian with a few thousand dollars and a mortgage she couldn't afford.
And after he died, I found out he sent him another $14,000, and we didn't have $14,000.
When she checked his cell phone, she saw one of the last calls he ever made
was to Jim.
I'm the one that told him Terry died. Because right after Terry died, I called him and he goes, well, I was wondering, I hadn't heard from him. It's like, fuck you. Anyway, I said, you know, I see that Terry sent you money and I want you to send it back to me. I don't have any money. He said, oh, I'll send you $3,000. So I didn't hear from him. And I think I called him one day and I said, you know, what's going on, Jim? And he goes, well, if you'll just send me $500, I'll be able to send you $3,000. And I said, you've got to be kidding me. And I hung up on him and I never called him again.
Hi, can you connect me to? Can you connect me to Jim Stuckey's room?
Okay.
Hello.
Hi, Mr. Stuckey.
Yes.
At some point listening to the tapes, I knew I had to meet Jim. At least I had to try. I wanted to stand up to him in a way my dad didn't. And so I found Jim, still living in a hotel in Manila.
I'm Terry Robinson's daughter. I'm Maggie Robinson.
And what was your first name again?
Maggie. I'm Terry's daughter.
And what was that? I can't hear it.
Oh, Maggie. M-A-G-G-I.
Dottie? Is it?
Maggie, Terry Robinson's daughter.
And Dottie. Okay. Well, you know, I'm waiting for a conference call here.
Okay.
And the story that we're going to get into with Terry is going to take quite a while to get the entire story out.
Oh, my God. I cannot wait to hear it. But
it's a very interesting story. I think that everybody would be interested in it. Terry was a very good man and a good friend.
I know.
I can't believe how I sound. I'm talking to the guy who maybe conned my dad, and I sound like this?
But actually, I would love to come and meet you and hear the story in person.
Yeah, I don't have a problem with that.
Awesome.
We're here on humanitarian services, so we don't have any hidden agenda.
Well, I'll email you as I get my trip planned more, and I'm really looking forward to seeing you and talking with you.
Thank you very much. I look forward to seeing you.
Okay, me too. Okay, have a good day.
Thank you. All right, bye.
I mean, tip number one, don't go.
Maria Konnikova.
And don't underestimate old men. No, seriously, they're sometimes the most vicious. They are people who've been con artists their entire life. And if you think they have end-of-life regrets, think again. I mean, I don't think Jim is going to assault you, but someone else might.
I'm not sure if Jim conned my family. It's possible he really did believe the treasures were real. Or maybe there's some other explanation. But Maria thinks that if there's even a potential that Jim is a con artist, is reason enough not to meet him.
And because Jim is old, he's going to use that against you. Say, look at me like I'm a poor man, and you'll see him, and he's going to actually look much more pathetic to you than he looks to anyone else. He's going to make sure of it. You know, he's going to arrive with a catheter, and he, seriously, looking just really, just, you know, he's doing everything he can for you. And he's going to talk to you, and he's going to seem nice, and you're going to say, oh, like, you know, maybe he's not such a bad guy.
So you don't think I should meet him?
No. I don't think, I mean, no, I don't. I think that once that happens and they breach kind of the distance between the two of you, that's the moment that objectivity stops. That's why it's always very easy to tell when other people have been conned, but the people in the con can't tell, and we judge them for it.
Thanks, Maria.
Of course.
I just
Good
realized,
luck.
Oh, thank you.
Seriously, stay with you. Like, be careful.
Okay. Yeah. Now I know you're right. Like, be careful. I still don't think this is a good idea.
That's Maria Konnikova speaking with Maggie Robinson-Katz. Our story, The Long Distance Con, continues next week when, maybe not surprisingly, Maggie chose to ignore her expert's advice.
So what are we about to do?
We're about to get on this plane to Manila to go meet Jim.
Still to come today. Oh my God, it's Joan Jett.
Whatever it is you want to be in life, don't let other people sort of hold you back.
Stick around.
I wish I had my sweatshirt with me. I'd give you a sweatshirt. But I hate being cold. It's
Once
dry.
We start gabbing, maybe it'll...
You want me to eat it?
Yeah, that's
okay.
So should we put these on yet, or what?
Sure.
Okay.
Last week, staff writer Sarah Larson met one of her childhood heroes, Joan Jett. They sat down to talk about a new documentary about Jett's career called Bad Reputation. And if you were listening to rock and roll in the 1980s, you couldn't miss Joan Jett. She had a string of hits including I Love Rock and Roll, Crimson and Clover, Bad Reputation, and a lot of others. She was kind of glam, kind of punk, and eventually just classic rock. Starting with her group The Blackhearts, Jett led the band, played guitar, sang the lead, all of it. For a girl growing up in the 80s, a music fan like Sarah Larson, that was huge.
I loved this new documentary about you and your music, Bad Reputation, and it felt like the movie was timelier than I expected it to be. You know, I'm a fan, so I knew I would love it. But when I put your music on in my headphones after mm-hmm. seeing your story and hearing uh-huh. the music, I walked down 6th Avenue and I just felt like I owned it. I felt very powerful and excited and happy. And it reminded me of how I felt when I was a kid when I was listening to you. When I was about 9 and I'd request I Love Rock and Roll at the roller rink.
Wow.
And then skating to it just uh-huh. felt so right. To have a woman owning that song and that feeling just felt so right when I was a kid, and it feels so right now. And it feels very welcome.
You know, you're the first person that I've gotten a response or a review from, I guess, basically. Certainly a woman that's seen this and made me want to cry when you said what you said, because that's exactly the intention that you want to get across, at least I do, with the music.
Yeah.
Is that you want to reach people, connect, and make them feel... you know, powerful in their own, whatever it is that they want to try to achieve. It doesn't have to be rock and roll, you know, whatever it is you want to be in life, don't let other people sort of hold yeah. you back. So you hearing that from you makes me feel like we achieved
like
the whole
you're
point
at the
of
roller
it.
Rink and yeah.
Yeah, totally, exactly.
So let's talk about how you came to play rock and roll and you getting your first guitar when you were a kid. Your parents gave you a guitar for Christmas.
They sure did. An electric guitar.
An electric guitar.
I was specific.
Yeah. What kind of guitar was it?
It was a Sears Silvertone.
You took lessons and you wanted to play rock and roll.
Yes.
And what happened?
Well, the guy told me girls don't play rock and roll. I'm sure I went in there all excited and exuberant as a young teenager would. Teach me how to play rock and roll. And he could have said, okay, great, let me teach you the basics. Let's learn some basic chords, and then I can teach you some rock songs. But he didn't. He said, girls don't play rock and roll. And, you know, I realized at that time, so you're not telling me that girls can't master the guitar. What you're saying is, I can't be the Rolling Stones, is what you're telling me. Right. I want to be the Rolling Stones. Rock and roll, just by its nature, exudes sexuality. So a girl playing rock and roll, it's going to be sexual. And Americans are very uncomfortable with that, you know, with, I think, with women and sexuality in general. But you know, when you get to teenagers expressing themselves, forget about it.
Yeah. I like that in the movie you talk about how you weren't rebelling against your parents. You were, I think, more rebelling against attitudes like that.
Yes, absolutely. It was more about what society telling, kind of pretending that we could be anything, but not really, you know, walking the walk, talking the talk, but not really letting girls do that.
And then you encountered some of that attitude as a teenager in your band, The Runaways.
When a lot of it.
Some people loved you guys. In Japan, it was like Beatlemania. But then you also got a lot of sexist pushback.
Yeah, it was very confusing in one respect until you kind of caught on. And I still don't really understand what's so threatening about it. But it's people were pushing back against us. And when they couldn't kind of throw us off base that way, then they started calling us names and would be extremely rude and call us every name in the book and or you know, just try to drive the subject always about talking about sex as opposed to the music.
And right.
I find it kind of childish, actually. You know, say, come on, man, is that that's where you're going to go?
And some of that is part of what inspired you to write after The Runaways, to write Bad Reputation, right? Was that?
Well, definitely. I was just reflecting on kind of how people threw my own ambition back in my face, trying to give it sort of a tinge of deviance.
Yeah.
Something's wrong with her that she wants to play guitar. And so I was really, when I met my best friend and producer, songwriting partner, Kenny Laguna, sort of just, you know, talking about subjects to write songs about, talking about my life, it was sort of a natural flow that we discuss these subjects and then sort of turn it on its head and make fun of that sort of a tongue-in-cheek way and say, I don't give a damn about my bad reputation.
Yeah. One of the things I really, really love about this song and about your music in general is this irresistible combination of catchiness and real power, real strength. And I was so intrigued in the movie to learn that Kenny had this background in writing bubblegum records.
Yes. Yes.
And the whole connection between bubblegum and punk.
Right, right.
Can you talk about that sound and what combination of elements you were looking for?
And that's a unique combination. It's, you know, it's a... Kenny comes from the Brill Building history of songwriting, and the combination, of his bubblegumness and you know, I really respect it, and I have that in myself as well. So yeah, the combination just really works well.
He said he brought that, and you brought the menace.
Yeah,
which I really liked.
Yeah,
but it's a very warm kind of menace.
Yes.
Somehow at all.
Yeah, it's not a nasty menace.
Yeah, exactly. Then another, you know, I was thinking of the combination of elements in your music about power and melody and joy and rage and love and strength, and how I loved all those things about Nirvana. And then I suddenly remembered that I actually had the great pleasure of seeing you play with Nirvana. I happened to be writing about that Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2014 where they were inducted, which was such a powerful moment. And to have all these women, these great, powerful women in the Kurt role was so wonderful. And you kicked it off with Smells Like Teen Spirit.
Can you imagine how it was like being asked? I was petrified on one level.
Yeah.
Not only do you have to be there enough for the band to play the song, but the fans.
Yeah.
You know, and I was strangely very calm that night. Mm. Like I knew I wouldn't mess it up. I think, you know, on some level there had to be some spirit there because I wasn't doing it, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it does.
Who knows?
And then the next year, you and Kenny, I believe, were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Yes, yes.
And that's a nice moment in the movie, too. I mean, you can see, you know, there's a standing ovation for you in this giant stadium, and there's Paul McCartney and Yoko Ono, and everybody's cheering, and that.
Yeah, it was actually Paul McCartney, when I came out, him and Ringo, I believe, were the first to stand up. And, I you know, I had planned on keeping it together. But, you know, seeing that and then the whole building stand up, it was just more than I could handle emotionally. And I just broke down, you know. So I didn't expect it, you know.
That was a nice moment.
It was.
There have been a lot of portrayals of you in pop culture in various ways, not just in the Runaways movie, which you executive produced, I think, right?
Right, yeah.
Like, I was watching this series, Red Oaks, and there was a you character in it. And I was watching this show, Younger, and there was a character who seemed like a composite of you and maybe Chrissy Hynde and some other things. And I just, what do you see in what the culture sees in you?
Perseverance, you know, fighting for what you believe in, you know, sort of just, if I can really step back from myself, it's very hard to talk about yourself like this.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it's like a type. It's a style.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I heard about this years ago more from fashion shows. I want a kind of a Joan Jett look. So I can only imagine that, you know, it means stark, dark hair, you know, dark makeup, I don't really know, but it's a type.
Yeah. What do you want people to take away from your story? Perseverance, for one thing.
Yeah, I mean, that's a big one. Don't let other people dictate what your life is going to be. You know, people tend to shoot down other people's dreams, and I don't know what that is in human nature that seems to go there. So I would say watch for that.
Yeah.
So if there's something you really want to do or be in life, you have to go for it. I think it's really, really important to not let other people dictate your life.
Well, I know that when I want to feel charged up, it helps to listen to a little Joan Jett.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for being here. It's been really great talking to you.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Sarah. Thanks for having me.
Joan Jett, the Joan Jett. She talked with Sarah Larson, who writes about culture in all its forms on NewYorker.com. The documentary Joan Jett, Bad Reputation, is out now.
Is there anything else you want to say, Joan?
Go see the movie.
I've seen it twice.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
I cried both times.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's great.
The good crying.
Yes. I saw it. I did, too. You know, it was I went on the journey again.
Yeah.
Now, Joan's a hard act to follow, and we're not even going to try. That's it for today. Hope you enjoyed the show, and I hope you'll tune in next time. I'm David Remnick. Have a good week.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Maggie Robinson Katz's story was produced by Daniel Guillemette with Ben Katz and Mac Montandon, with assistance from Michelle Moses and Zach Helfand. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Avi Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Cal Aaliyah, Karen Frillman, David Krasnow, Louis Mitchell, Sarah Nix, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Emily Mann, Trent Williamson, and Jessica Henderson. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.